Hello, humans. Welcome to the Jerome Powell Experience. This is episode 40 of your Power Report, and I'm joined by Bam and Sean to either side of me.
And hello.
Bam, who once again refuses to stay in frame. Sean, who graciously joins us after being like literally 5 minutes in a previous engagement otherwise, just to go. But, you know, we're busy people. It's a busy show, and we have a lot to report for you. On this episode, we have... A little bit later, I'll be getting myself into some trouble, as you probably tell by the title and some other things, with Joe Rogan and Kyle Kulinski. That's all stuff I want to say for the very end of the episode, because it's A, that's how you tease things, and B, I think it's a really kind of important point to kind of close with, to bring a lot of the points we'll be talking about in this episode together. But we've also got stuff on Amir Locke, a shooting of a black person that you may not have heard of because the media is failing miserably. What else is new? The Russia-Ukraine story. It's a situation we all know of. People are worried about, once again, whether or not we're going to go into another war, unnecessary or otherwise, and we are going to once again just define what's going on for you, because everywhere else in the media is utterly failing you. And book bans. We love ourselves some book bans. And I think there was some other... am I missing
Canadian
some
segment? Truckers.
Oh, no. I am going to be talking about that in the members portion of the episode. So if you're a member, you will get to hear some stuff about Gavin Newsom going on for quitting on Medicare for All, essentially. He was running on it. I made a big deal about it, and then he decided, nah, not much of a thing I'm going to care about that much. So we'll be talking about that as well. And then there are truckers in Canada that are getting a lot of attention from right-wingers. And for some reason, people, because there are people who are making this argument now, but that's why we have Power Report. There are people who are conflating the truckers argument with a workers' rights argument, when in reality, it's just right-wingers in America who are jumping onto this for anti-vax reasons, but more on that later. If you want to get the full episode of Power Report, so all the segments I just mentioned, especially those two, the Gavin Newsom one and the Canadian Truckers one, become a Syndicate 23 member at join.syndicate23.co. It helps grow what we're doing, not only just on Power Report, but on Audio Face, but also future things we're doing. And yeah, it is also really fun because you get bonus stuff as well. And also remember to follow Power Report on Twitter and Instagram at Power Report. WRLD on Twitter and powerreport.world on Instagram. Could make that more confusing, could make it yet less confusing. Who knows? You can just find the links in the description. And also check me out on Good Morning Bad News on TikTok. If you use TikTok, you're going to do that. We just passed 1 million followers on there. And so that's been really fun indoctrinating the youths on that. And thank you, Peter, for mastering all of the episodes of this podcast, making it sound really nice. At deadmusic666 on Insta is where you can find them. And so with that, we go in to book bans. And so on Power Report, we don't simply just, you know, like watch the news. We actually watch the news and what they're doing, meaning we pay as much attention to the news stories as we do to the coverage itself. And so that means we could tell you that this time last year, the entire Republican Party was scrambling for some kind of message. They had just had their former president finish a failed coup on January 6th. And we learned just this week in 2022 that there was also an executive cover-up angle, where apparently Trump was getting rid of phone records and paper records that were just wiped due to on January 6th, that could have given a lot of insight into his involvement in the attempted subversion of election results that people already had. So you had the situation last year where the Republican Party had nothing to really talk about, nothing to really go over, nothing policy agenda to talk about, really. All they wanted to do was their same thing they did back when Obama was in office and just stop the Democrats from accomplishing anything. But what the Democrats really wanted to accomplish was COVID relief. And so that one was a really hard one to obstruct. Nevertheless, they persisted. And they also spent their time talking a lot about cancel culture and talking a lot about Dr. Seuss books at some schools that some teachers decided to pull from their curriculum because of outdated and racially charged language. The Republican media spent day in, day out talking about nothing but this. Oh no, these Dr. Seuss books. Oh no, these Sesame Street characters. This dumb distractions that went away from the fact that they had no actual policy agenda to talk about, which is what we were talking about on Power Report at the time, that the Republicans had no policy platform or agenda other than cancel culture and whatever Donald Trump was doing at any given day. And with that power vacuum, there was nothing they could really do but just oppose Democrats and be reactionary. Fast forward a year later, and books that teach kids about race and history in an updated way with more and better information, as you're supposed to do when time goes on and you get more people who are able to dig deeper into history and find some of the things that are lost to help us paint a clearer picture of what happened in the past. These books are now being banned from some schools. And would you believe it, the same people who last year warned about censorship in the context of getting rid of Dr. Seuss books are now worried about censorship in the context of, you know, preventing these books that could actually teach kids about the horrors of history and maybe give them some insight onto how to spot these things now and how to make sure these things don't repeat. And so I know I want to bring it to the panel here because you've been seeing some of these things that have been happening as well, where now Republicans are on this onslaught to make sure that they ban critical race theory in schools and ban all these things that are being taught. So what are some of the stuff that like you are feeling and reacting to as the stuff's happening?
I couldn't hear if you said me or not, but I'm going to go anyway. Let me just start off by saying congratulations, Dan, on that million followers on TikTok.
Thank you, Ben.
Wow, this has been insane, the whole anti-CRT. There's a part of me that thought it would be kind of over by now. Like, I thought it was going to be similar to the Republicans focusing on cancel culture. That lasted for a few weeks, maybe a month or so. But it seems like they're really focused on this agenda, and it's really showing their fascist nature, honestly. We have at least, I think there's about, states with anti-critical race theory bans: Arkansas, Florida, Idaho, Iowa, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. And I think there's either 16 or 18 states that have bills moving through the state legislature right now. There's also, we have the what they're calling the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida with Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, the third most populous state in the United States of America, out there campaigning for this bill that would effectively ban subjects concerning the LGBTQ community. And I've heard some other stuff about that bill, but I'm not going to say because I'm not sure about that. But yeah, I don't know what's going to happen if these people successfully ban teaching true history in this country, or at least in these states. But I do know that it will have catastrophic results. If you can lawfully, if you can use the law to lie to people, it's going to turn these next generations into brown shirts, basically. I mean, that's how I see it. And what are you going to use? Where does it stop? If you're doing this in public schools, is it next in the public libraries? Is it next in the public universities? You know, who knows?
It's the irony of it is hilarious because they're the ones who are always touting free speech and touting how everything's going to be 1984. You know, the government's going to control everything. They're going to ban all this stuff. They're going to ban all of these conservative things or whatnot, or make you do this, but they're the ones that are trying to ban certain things or make you do, make bans on freedom of speech. Like you have the anti-BDS laws in Georgia, Texas, and a couple others where you can't even talk about BDS at all. And even some of the politicians have to sign those things. And it's like, that's a direct thing of against freedom of speech. Like, how are you guys never talking about that? But there's these conservatives that run up and say, oh, we're going to get canceled if we go on campus or this or that. But I'm like, you're all the ones who are doing the canceling because you're supporting those things. And the thing, too, with this is a big issue in America is the lack of open-mindedness in schools, I feel like, where they don't really teach you a lot of different things that other educational systems will get. So you won't get a really good worldview on history and whatnot. Like I remember going through, you know, junior high school, and they're barely touch about, you know, international relations between countries or things that have happened in the past, which make you understand the current climates right now. Like example, Russian Ukraine, there's a giant history there, which we'll more touch on more later, but people barely know about it here because they don't teach it. And if you don't teach things, people aren't going to learn. And you have all of these things where Republicans will want to ban it, or they will want to do it because they're, you know, the fascist tendencies, the racist tendencies to do things abruptly like that. But with that, it just makes things worse. You're not going to learn about things that you need to learn about when you're young. You want to learn as much as you can, so that way you don't repeat the same mistakes in history. Example, and the example I will always give is in Germany, you have to learn about the Holocaust, like right away. They will always teach you about it as much as you can because they don't want history to repeat itself. That's why certain things are banned, like swastikas are banned in Germany. And if you have any of this stuff, like you can get thrown in jail for a lot of that things because they don't want that to happen. They are extremely ashamed of their history and they're trying to, you know, move themselves forward past that. So they teach the younger generation as much as they can about that stuff. But in here, it's the polar opposite. They just try to brush it down. And you actually even get that in Japan too, where they won't talk about some of their imperialism and stuff in the early 20th century. And that's, it causes problems where if you don't talk about it, you're not going to learn. And it's also the other thing too, Republicans can't fucking define CRT anyways. They don't know what it is. I barely know what it is. And I'm a damn socialist. Like, who cares? That's not, who the fuck is teaching CRT in schools, dude? Like, I have some hippie flip-flop wearing socialist dudes some of my history professors before, and they don't even know what it is. Like, come on now. It's such a minute, small thing that someone getting their doctorate in philosophy, sure, they'll know what it is and they'll learn about it, but they're not. It's all bullshit. It's all fugazi. It's like fucking NFTs.
I like the fact that you use the example of, like, teaching the Holocaust in Germany, for example, because it goes directly to what's happening in Tennessee and people going against Art Spiegelman and his book Mouse, which is an allegory about the Holocaust. And the idea of not teaching that in Tennessee, which, like a lot of areas of the South in the United States, are going under their own issue with a rise in white nationalism and a rise in extremism, should be able to, like, kids should be able to spot these things and see why these things are wrong. Because the counterpoint is, oh, these things are controversial topics that will be taught at home or parents will teach about them. A, parents are not teaching anything to their kids. They don't have time to teach math or science or history or whatever. B, okay, let's say they are. Can we trust they're on, like, you know, a good curriculum? Can we trust they're not just imparting their own beliefs onto their kids? Because most likely, that's what parents are going to do, regardless of their political ideology. And that goes back to what you're having right now, where you have a country where you have a rise in right-wing extremism and a rise in white identity nationalism. And the two and two are tied together, and they are coming together as, like, this. I had an episode of PowerPoint that was called History Echoes that is, like, saying, okay, well, I'm not saying that Trump is going to get reelected and then start rounding up members of minority groups, but you have to look at the signs of what was it like before, you know, World War II started. What was it like before Adolf Hitler rose to power? And then you had historical events like Kristallnacht and all these other different things that led to the Holocaust. And what does it mean to say that you have people to this day who deny that the Holocaust even happened? That's a major travesty. It's a major part of a growing significant part of American political discourse, unfortunately, because we've done such a poor job about educating people in schools and in American society about these things. And it was bad, but at least, like, Sean and I got some of these things in school. You're getting even less of it to none of it now. And you're actually having a party who is working on actively banning these things from classes and from schools. Like, it is very dangerous.
The only reason why I know so much about it is because I'm German. So it's like, it's crazy where, like, a lot of that stuff you won't get, but bam, you're gonna talk. Go.
Yeah. I remember, this is anecdotal, but I remember in a history class, I can't remember if I was in a junior or senior in high. Oh, I think it was a junior actually in high school. And in our history class, the teacher is talking about slavery, and he said it to all of our people in the class. He was like, oh, you know, like slavery wasn't that bad because, you know, they didn't want to treat the slaves. They didn't want to like treat them so poorly because then they wouldn't be able to work. So it's like your cattle, like you don't treat your cattle poorly because then it won't, you know, it can't produce the milk that you want and it can't do the, like can't do the work that you want it to do. And I just remember looking around and nobody was saying anything. And so I raised my hand and was like, well, no, that's not the case because people used to like risk their lives to leave the plantation. And at that time, you know, we were talking about like what you learn at home. My mom was a well-educated person. She had a lot of books and I would read a lot of them. And I knew the story of Margaret Garner who killed her daughter. So her daughter wouldn't be returned as a slave. So I was like, no, that's not the case. They would literally risk death and mutilation to get off those plantations. They would try to kill the plantation owners, yep. The overseers. They would do all kinds of things that would have really bad consequences to not be enslaved. And then when I said that, he was like, well, I was just seeing if anybody would say anything. But if nobody says anything, you have a bunch of students, whoever is listening, you know, it's a high school class, not everybody's paying attention, but you know, they're going to be going out and saying, well, you know, slavery wasn't that bad. Just like Bill O'Reilly said, when he was talking about when Michelle Obama mentioned that the White House was built by slaves, he was like, well, it wasn't that bad. You know, they had good food and good shelter, you know, they're building the White House, you know, so it couldn't have been that bad. That then, narrative can lead to so much damage. Like you're not going to have any kind of polite, decent democracy if people don't know history. And I'm one of the people that think that things are as bad as they are with the racial tension and different things like that because of a lack of honest, honesty when teaching the history of this nation.
I agree. They all. None of them know who, your history teacher definitely did not know who Nat Turner was, but okay.
But he probably did, but this is the person that's wanting to indoctrinate the students to
100%.
It seemed like that was the case.
100%. But it goes to show you too, like the failure of the American educational system, right? Like the American educational system is broken as fuck. It's really bad at teaching, especially history.
Is it a failure or is it on purpose? You know,
and I was going to say, it's like, it's also set up in that way on purpose to really show you that, America is great. Like you always, it's stuck in this 50s mindset, right? Like it's stuck, I mean, in this curriculums and everything, especially history teaching, it's all stuck in the ways of the Red Scare, that America's great. We just won the Second World War. We do nothing wrong. Look how great our history is, blah, blah, blah. Here's Lewis and Clark. Here's some other white dudes doing random things. That's awesome. But they don't talk about the real shit that's going on. They don't talk about that we had a war against Spain that was total fugazi because we destroyed a ship ourselves because we wanted more money. They didn't talk about the English coming over again in 1812, burning down the White House and it being rebuilt by slaves. They don't talk about the things that have happened in this country that need to be talked about, right? In other countries, you'll get that educational system. Again, like in Germany, we'll talk about the Holocaust. We'll talk about things that are really hard to talk about, but they need to be. Like you can't skirt around history or else it's going to repeat itself. If you don't get out of a certain mindset, if you don't talk about stuff, then you're never going to learn about it and you're never going to learn about all of the atrocities that have gone, all the things that have happened against people that it can easily happen again. And it's really sad with that. Like America is so close-minded when it comes to that, when it comes to racial tensions, when it comes to, you know, having a different political ideology, right? Like that's one thing that really bothers me here is like, if you have anything radical in the way, they'll just label you whatever they want, even though they don't understand any of it. Like example, CRT, socialism, communism, whatever it is. They're like, it's a socialist, radical, communist, Marxist shit. And you're like, what does that even mean? But they don't know what they're talking about half the time.
No, not only does that not mean anything, but it is something that it's another case of the Democrats who, unfortunately, it's a two-party system. You get the Republican Party response, you get the Democratic media machine, their apparatus, and their response. But you get a Democratic media apparatus, a Democratic media machine that takes these, you know, like fake scares, like critical race theory, or these fake moral panics, like cancel culture, and runs with them. and makes it into their entire political policy. Like, they don't actually fight against these things. They don't do the work to loudly not only just debunk these things, but offer something else to people instead of this. Like saying, hey, instead of getting upset about, this is a good opportunity to say, hey, instead of getting upset about cancel culture, you want to see real cancel culture? They're trying to make it so you can't teach about the Holocaust. The Republican Party is like, do you want to know how hard you can weaponize that and turn, like, the Democrats can turn AIPAC and sick them on the Republican Party if they message this the right way? It would put AIPAC in a corner, which could be really useful for some other contexts in painting the hypocrisies of that organization as well. But it would put them in a corner to go ham on the Republican Party for all these things and force them to back down from it politically, because they would lose a major constituency and of voters and a major constituency of support if they were to be confronted publicly with the idea of, banning Holocaust books and banning books about race and banning books about gender. And then they were to go, yes, we're going to do that. And we're going to go really hard in doing that. If you lump all together all these things and tie it together with a Republican strategy of they have nothing to do but tear the country apart. They have no policies but to sow discontent socially and politically and economically until there's nothing left but looting for rich people. Until the Democrats make that message, I think we're going to be stuck in this loop.
They should ban the Turner Diaries.
Bam, last word.
I just wanted to say that, you know, we often talk about how people will vote against their own interests. And I think that, when you don't teach real history, it's really easy to divide, to use like the divide and conquer tactic. And that's what we see day in and day out. We have a lack of solidarity between the classes because, the powers that be, whatever, like the malicious powers, they sow discontent and they just divide and conquer. And they're able to do that because people don't know like the history of the really, really strong labor movements that we've had in this country that were, you know, shut down violently and through all kinds of means. When people don't know that, it's really easy to keep them separate from each other and fighting for like choosing solidarity over division.
I would definitely agree with that.
I 100% agree. I mean, my the biggest thing, like, I guess that was eye-opening for me. I guess a little bit of a personal story. What during this early high school, late junior high-ish, when history classes, because I'm like obsessed with a lot of just geopolitical issues, always have been my whole life. But when they were talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I don't remember if this is freshman year of high school, maybe around that time they're talking about that, but they never brought up why it happened in the first place, that Americans put, you know, nuclear missiles in Turkey, and that's what set the whole thing off, and they never talked about that. And I had to raise my voice and say, oi, like, the whole point of Castro putting the missiles right next to or close to Florida was because we did it first. But they never talked about that. And I go, how are you going to just braze over that? It's just, it's so dishonest and it's disrespectful to your own base of teaching and whatnot too. It's just, there's so much that happens here that the right will never talk about it here. You know, they'll be as hypocritical as possible because it suits their agenda and their tendencies and all that. But if anyone ever says, like, if you're ever in a debate or one out with the conservative and they say, oh, CRT is running rampant, ask them, what the fuck does CRT even mean? Like, explain it to me. It's the same thing if, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene says, that's communist socialist antichrist. You're like, what does that even mean? Define it for me, please. Define me the specific things between communism and socialism. What's the differences? You know, have at it.
That's definitely
They're not going to know.
That's another thing to do too as well, is to not only not accept their framing, but to also force them to actually define the terms they're talking about. Like, go into it more. Like,
exactly.
But also not do it in a way that allows them to spread misinformation, but do it in a way that allows them to, like, get, like, hung by their own stupidity. I want to move on. Before that, just want to also note that elsewhere on Syndicate 23, we are continuing with Audio Face as well. That's releasing every single week. And we've got new albums coming out this week as well, or at least recently as to when this episode's coming out, including what we have on the docket right now is Snot with an dollar sign, which is how that works, Alt-J and Hippocampus, and many more albums that'll be coming out throughout February. We have our State of Music conversation as well, which you can check out all these things by following Audio Face Pod on Twitter at Audio Face Pod or Instagram at Audio Face Pod. That one's a little bit easier. And of course, becoming a Syndicate 23 member to support all those things and getting all that stuff early. Also, I'll say in the ad block here, just because I am here, hi, Caesar. Happy birthday. We wish you a happy birthday. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it to this episode, but we miss him and we'll see him soon, or at least some of us miss him. I'm not sure how, at what stage of the argument slash abusive relationship that is the We Made It podcast currently is. But
Sean is over there using that audio face language, I see.
Audio face language. There's a lot that could be encompassed with audio face language. So I'm just going to say,
do you like? There's multiple ways to for audio face language, my guy. Which one? Yeah. Which one?
I'd like to move on to, I think, something that, to segue from what we were just talking about to now the next segment, which is basically what happens when you get a country that is poorly informed about geopolitical topics that happen outside of the borders of the United States, and when it's confronted with real world applicable situations where, okay, a populace has to decide who is telling them the truth on things, who is not, and where their interests best lie. And to be honest, it's a little bit hard to do from the outset. So just to kind of jump in right now, apparently, allegedly, Russia may be on the brink of a battle with Ukraine of some sorts. We know that Russians' troops have sort of started to amass and take what NATO has quoted as aggressive action and moving troops towards the Ukrainian border. Some numbers are saying to the tune of like six figures, 100,000 or more. There have been talks that have happened since around November-ish that have gone back and forth between NATO, Russia, Ukraine, and then NATO, of course, making all of the NATO allies, which includes Britain, France, Germany, the United States, Canada, and a number of other nations, you know, related to that. Basically, all of those who are not Russia, the former allied powers, so to speak. And talks since November have really not really gone anywhere and essentially have deteriorated, so to speak. And so you've had different battles here where there's a cyber attack that is believed to be Russian done in mid-January that took down a lot of major websites in Ukraine. In the middle of Ukraine, they're preparing for a blockade where you have members of just regular citizens training with wooden guns, preparing for some type of blockade of the city. Like it's old school style. You're seeing reports from the United States government of different escalations that the Russians are doing, and therefore reasons why the United States would have to escalate on economic sanctions, on political measures. You even saw terms like lethal aid being used, saying like lethal aid is being deployed to the region, which is another way of saying they're sending troops. They're sending guns. There's no such thing as lethal aid that isn't preparation for war or conflict or battle. Okay, so once again, where the United States sits right now is we have media institutions that, for many reasons, I've expressed it in the Dan from the Internet video, Bad News, that folks can check out. But there's a number of different reasons why our media institutions are not trustworthy on issues that relate to foreign policy and relate to foreign conflict. We've seen how quickly the media manufactured consent, to borrow a Chomskyan phrase, for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan that we are just now ending, that has become a series of forever wars and conflicts in the Middle East to justify our multi-billion dollar military budget every year. And when you take that all together, that media system is being informed by members of the government who have their own interests. Then those interests are maintaining that bloated military budget, making sure it keeps going, making sure there's a justification for those projects, making sure that if you have a voice in the media to inform people, it's that those people are scared and worried about what might happen. And so they are fine with us having continued more of a military budget, because Russia might be an enemy and China might be an enemy. And who knows, whatever, there might be an enemy out there, Americans. So watch out. We need to continue bolstering up and spending more money on fighter jets that don't work. And so, Bam, you know a lot about these foreign policy kind of things. And I know you like came in here with a lot of points about Ukraine that you wanted to touch on. But one of the first points was that the situation is inflated early by mainstream media because war sells and it boosts defense contracts and it boosts their stocks higher. Feel free to elaborate on that and also other things you want to discuss as far as this whole Ukraine situation goes, because I think this is a good opportunity for us to sort of reset a lot of what has been said, the noise in mainstream media right now, and to actually talk about what's going on. So Bam, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I first started, a friend of mine texted me like, oh my God, is there going to be a war? And I was like, I don't think so. Like, there was definitely a few days in January where people were freaking out. And, you know, when you hear, you know, for those of us that follow geopolitics, you kind of, you know, when you see those big countries, you're not thinking of like a hot war. So I was never really like that afraid. I'm like, well, I don't really think anything's going to happen, but you know, you never know, I guess. But yeah, for sure. Those headlines are, you know, that fear of a war sells big time. You know, we saw that, we've seen that our whole lives really. And yeah, and it gives, you know, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and all these other guys, Boeing, you know, it boosts their sales and you never know. It's a really powerful industry. You know, Russia's military industrial complex is very strong too. You know, it could be both sides. You know, it could be they're trying to sell it over here and they're trying to sell it over there so they can get more money themselves, those companies.
Really fast, Bam, I want to kind of get to, maybe this is what you're saying, maybe this isn't, but I think this is an important point to make, is that the Ukrainian government has an interest, and a lot of time that interest is not aligned with its people. Same can be said for the Russian government. Same can be said for the United States government. And so as a result, you have to understand that these governments have these interests, and when they're speaking publicly, that is what you have to consider. And so that is oftentimes different from the truth of the matter, as I think Bam is what's talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a lot of things I had written down, but I do want to say this because, you know, I think there can be a tendency on the left to, you know, for sure, I think America is the great Satan, like 100%. There's no
country. On God, no doubt.
Yeah, there's no country that's done more damage more than the United States of America for the past probably 100 years.
Inshallah.
It doesn't mean that because America's so bad, like all the other countries are good. You know, it doesn't mean that Russia or Putin doesn't have a negative role in this situation. It's hard to say or really know because, you know, thinking of the media landscape in America, it's bad, but like it's way worse in Russia. So it's hard to get any truth out of the situation. And then if you're looking at Ukrainian media, it's hard to know as well. You know, it's not as open as it is. There isn't like as much of a sense of independent media in Russia as we do here. Here, yeah, if you're just looking at Fox and CNN and MSNBC, you're going to get a little bit of truth and mostly lies. But here we have independent media that you can, you know, trust for the most part. And you'll know better if you know history. But yeah, I don't think that because, you know, Russia is saying that this has to do with NATO, and I just don't really buy it. I do feel like there's something duplicitous going on. I've heard a lot about the COVID situation in Russia. I don't think that Putin is a friend to his people or like people globally. He's definitely not a friend to the left. He's a right-wing populist. He also dabbles in a lot of the same narratives that the right-wing agitators here in America do, and in Europe. You know, he befriends like the worst of the right-wing in Europe as well. But you know, either way, the answer for the situation isn't escalation, and it isn't, obviously it isn't war, and it isn't escalating that war. I am happy to see it. And I feel like we had talked about this in the past. I can't remember in what regard, but it did make me happy to see that France and Germany were taking a bit, taking a big role in the situation. And Germany decided not to send any aid to Ukraine. France has had, Macron has had conversations with Putin, and I think also the president or prime minister of Ukraine. You know, there's been some sense of diplomacy in regards to the situation. I think we've even had, I don't know who the people are anymore, like in the White House or in the administration, but there's, you've even had some people in America saying that we're not going to be having like American troops fighting for Ukraine. That's literally never going to happen. And I think because of that, this invasion by Russia is not going to happen either. But we've seen Russia be a bit of an agitator in the past. So I don't think there's going to be a war, but I do think that although this is a tense situation and nobody likes these situations, this situation could lead to us establishing more of a multipolar world and show in like the weakening of American hegemony. It isn't like America's necessarily taking the lead in this situation. We are seeing Germany and France take, and maybe at some other countries as well. And the reason why I know that's the case, that that's like actually having an effect, you saw Germany decide not to send lethal aid. You saw Macron having these conversations. We've seen diplomacy throughout different administrations of the European Union. And then after that, we see the United States and the United Kingdom saying, hey, if you're not, you know, any people that are in Ukraine, you should leave. So they're still trying to ramp it up, you know, like it seems like it's dying down, but they're trying to like ramp it up more. And that's still like those defense contracts, in my opinion, that's a little bit conspiratorial, but that's kind of how I see it.
And so like on that really
media too.
Yeah. On that really fast, Sean, cause I want to get your thoughts. I also want to get your thoughts on specifically to the extent that you understand, I think at this point now, France and Germany are in a multipolar kind of sense of BAM, like are operating less in a how do we toe the line with NATO sense and more of a, okay, what are our interests to Russia and what are our interests to the Ukraine and what are our interests to the United States? And like, what do we actually want to do here? So to what extent do you think that is at play, Sean? Do you think that's different compared to how it was, you know, in previous times we've had conflicts rising with Ukraine? And yeah, just kind of your general thoughts on the matter as well.
Well, with Ukraine, you also have to go back to how Ukraine gained independence in 91. There's a lot of tensions and stuff that have happened throughout the history of Ukraine. A lot of anti-Russian sentiment. I mean, look at 1986, the Chernobyl disaster. That was in Ukraine. Like, Pripyat's in Ukraine. And Russia fucked that up, and it messed up a lot of things for the Ukrainian people. So there's a lot of anti-sentiment that has been going on for a long time, like 40, 50 years. It's just a lot of tensions and other things. And when the fall of the Soviet Union happened, they gained independence, they did their thing. But Russia and a lot of the, you know, the Putin archetypes of the, you know, they want Russia to have their glory days back. They wanted to, you know, they're imperialists by nature. They're right-wing imperialists by nature. They always go on with these other guys that want to, you know, control as much as they can. They have these sentiments of, we own that. Like, that should be ours. And that's the whole thing. And even Ukraine, you had almost like the nation was kind of split between people who were very pro-Russian and wanted to be part of it. And you had people who said, no, fuck that. We want to have our own Ukraine. And you've always had this push-pull. You had, is it the Orange Revolution that happened in the early 2000s? I feel like Orange is usually considered Dutch, but I think it was something like that where they ousted a government in the mid-2000s, I believe, of like a pro-Russian government for the Ukrainian people because they didn't want that. And there's always like, there's been some elections that have been rigged and other things for the pro-Russian government to try to come up because they always want to have good relations with Russia and have more and more ties and more economic ties and stuff because when the collapse of the Soviet Union happened, you know, Ukraine has a lot of output, has a lot of things that, you know, Russia uses for energy and other things, but it's beyond the point. So there's there's a lot of time. There's a lot of stuff that you need to know prior hand into this. The other thing that needs to be said is both countries, Ukraine and Russia, have extreme neo-Nazis as well. They have like the extreme right in both countries. And I don't think that gets talked about, especially with circles on the left where, you know, people are like, well, we want to be anti-Russian because fuck Putin, but Ukraine isn't that great of a place either. Like, there was a lot of tensions and stuff when the Crimea happened quite a bit ago. You had all the stuff that happened when MH17 was shot down in 2014 and all these different rebel forces and whatnot that happened. But the one good thing out of this, which Bam touched on a bit, was A, I hate NATO. Like, NATO is a fucking disaster, like, for multitudes of reasons. They also have a part to play in this because, you know, France and Germany are doing diplomacy. They're doing things the right way of, hey, like, we're not, you know, you got to talk to both sides and figure this out, but we're not going to give, you know, military aid to Ukraine just because we hate Russia as well. But they, you know, everybody has their own reasons. Like, Germany doesn't want to piss off Russia because they want to use the oil pipeline, but that's a different story. But with, excuse me. But with like all the stuff that happened in the Crimea thing and everything else, they aren't, Ukraine aren't necessarily a friend to everybody. And with NATO, like, NATO isn't handling that well. But something that like Bam touched on with the diplomacy that France and Germany are using, if you look at the way the US is saying about it or the UK said about it, because everybody's favorite crazy hairy Brit was talking with the emissaries of Russia. They were saying, oh, we won't give military aid. Like, we won't, or like, we'll give sanctions to Russia if you guys do this. Like, we'll do all these other things where it's like, you're trying to, you know, escalate it. You're trying to make it worse because you always have these anti-Russia sentiments here and the UK, which stem from anti-communism things that have been going on since, you know, the early 50s. And remember, Biden's a dinosaur. Like, he grew up under McCarthyism. Like, you know, like, these old fucks in Congress are all anti-Russia, like, extreme anti-Russia and want to do things. Remember, it was only in the 90s when the Soviet Union fell, so they still have this mindset of, we want to do anything we can to beat Russia. But it's not necessarily a good thing to, you know, to align yourselves with Ukraine, because there's so many other things that go on that you got to do diplomacy. And also, there's never going to be boots on the ground for America over there. I would be shocked if that ever happened, because if that happens, shit's going down, someone's getting nuked. And that's the thing. Like, you can't, with these big global forces, and this has happened since this end of the Second World, you have proxy wars, and that's always what's going on. You have these little things that, you know, Vietnam, Korea, Iran, a bunch of others, proxy wars. Afghanistan, part 1, 2, and 3, proxy wars. So that's kind of like, in my mind, that's how I see it, is it's another little like proxy war to provoke the West to do that, to try and gain territorial advantage, because, you know, Russia is imperialist by nature and they want to have as much territorial control as they can. So the more diplomacy, the better. And thankfully, France and Germany are actually doing that. I'm shocked Macron is doing that too.
The thing I want to, those are all like really good points there. And I think there's a larger, broader context. And there's a thing I think about myself, to myself too, that arguably, this is another, if you want to go 50,000 foot view, not even the 30,000 foot view, but even a higher view of what's going on in historical context between the United States, Russia, and China vying for superpower status in this global power struggle, so to speak. You could be looking at sort of another, like a second Cold War that maybe we're currently in right now and not currently knowing about, because there is, you know, we have all these proxy 100%. Battles and conflicts, things that are going on. I don't want to get too far down that track in this part of the thing. I want to kind of wrap up the segment soon. But the main thing I want to say is that there are a lot of leftists out there, people who claim to be leftists, who are going, okay, let's just ally with whoever is the enemy of the United States, and that's the way to go. We'll also ally with Russia, maybe, or China, maybe, because, oh, they have some, you know, semblances of communism or Marxism, and Leninism is literally comes from there, and we like some of their like things, but
they're not your
these
friend.
People, they're not your friend. These people who are saying this online are very loud and not very well read, with not only past history of these areas, but recent history. It is not being a it is not speaking for the American imperial state to say that the Chinese imperial state or the Russian imperial state is not better, is would not be allies in our situation, cannot like help in some global struggle. To say that they're anything more than the American capitalists who are greedy bastards who are out for their own wealth and power is a just like, honestly, gross stupidity from a large amount of the white left who, like someone was saying earlier, doesn't really care about whatever power struggles or like minority situations are happening in individual countries or whatever. They mostly care about, okay, how can I win this theoretical debate on the internet about who is further to the left versus the actual tangible realities of what are happening for people on the ground there. And so all in all, this Russia-Ukraine situation is kind of messed up. The United States wants to, every country is in it for their own reasons. And
yeah,
that's better. And even though we can tell the United States is trying to ramp up war for its own reasons, that is better than the United States leading a coalition of nations behind them who are blindly going, yep, let's do whatever America says, and blindly go into another expensive, costly, deadly battle and conflict that does nothing to, yeah, solve anything and usually makes things worse. Amir Locke was a 22-year-old black man. He was killed seconds after waking up to police officers serving a no-knock warrant in Minneapolis. And this is another one of these types of warrants where essentially the cops can get a probable cause, or they can make up a probable cause and get a, basically rubber stamp approval to go into a house unannounced, guns drawn, and maybe the person they're looking for is there, maybe they aren't. A lot of times these are just fact-gathering search-finding missions that usually cops on the beat do search-finding missions by asking people questions and not pointing guns at them before asking them questions. But this is America. This is a particularly rough part of Minneapolis. And so Amir Locke was a little bit delirious. He was asleep on his couch at the time. And when he saw a bunch of people with lights and guns in his face yelling commands at him, he himself was armed and had a gun and was getting ready to use it. And then, as unfortunately is the case that happens here, he got lit the hell up by the police thugs who stormed into his apartment on very, very thin idea of evidence of like probable cause to even go in there. And so that's the Amir Locke story, but you wouldn't have heard of it from the so-called liberal cable news network or from so-called black civil rights activist Al Sharpton, because instead you would have heard bullshit like this.
No, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you go to a local pharmacy, Dwayne Reed or Rite Aid, any of them, and you got to get someone to help assist you. I mean, they have the little button there.
Yep.
You hit the buzzer and the guy comes over and unlocks your toothpaste. Yes. I mean, we're talking about basic stuff.
That's what I said.
What did I miss that we now have to lock up toothpaste?
Yeah.
And well, certainly,
there is a debate in the criminal justice system, and there are those that are concerned, including me, about overloading the system and the jails with petty crime. But at the same time, you cannot have a culture where people are just at random, just robbing and stealing, and is out of control and is put on the front page of newspapers, which only encourages others to do it. In fairness to Eric, he's only been mayor 5 weeks. But in but even as unfair to him, Eric, they're locking up my toothpaste.
I'll say,
come on, baby.
And so Al Sharpton, civil rights hero, who almost kind of sort of has this bent about speaking to the actual issues people are facing and the cycles of criminal injustice that lead to people to needing to steal toothpaste or needing to steal steaks from a Trader Joe's. You get him going, oh, where's my toothpaste? Where's my blueberry pie? What's going on with the, why can't I go to Joy Ann Reed and get my pharmaceuticals? Like what, these are supposed, these are supposed like black leaders, right? On Black History Month. And they should be talking about the fact that a 22-year-old black person was killed who had a right to own a gun. And because he lived in an apartment complex and may have been related to somebody in the neighborhood, someone who the cops were looking for, they just killed him point blank. He is dead. His life is over. And okay, there's all this like Black Lives Matter this, Black Lives Matter this. Does Amir Locke's life matter to Al Sharpton? Because he has all these checks. Al Sharpton loves getting those MSNBC checks. There's nothing Al Sharpton loves more than a blueberry pie and a check from Comcast, all right? But when it comes to using your platform to do something that isn't just self-serving, something that isn't just putting yourself up in the limelight, but something that's actually standing for what you supposedly stand for, there is nothing. And so I'll leave it up to the panel because I'll have some more words after this. But what were some of your thoughts to this, like, utter bullshit from the media and not really covering this story?
Well, former federal informant Al Sharpton is apparently going to be giving the eulogy for Amir Locke for his funeral. So that's interesting.
Okay, so he's doing the work, punk ass.
I guess Amir Locke's parents were on his show recently too. But I mean, you know, he's old. Like going to that segment itself, you know,
and wrinkly, and can't take a selfie. But that being said, bam, continue.
I you know, hearing him talk about shoplifting and things like that, like, I mean, it's definitely like some boomer conversation about, you know, oh my God, they're locking up the toothpaste. And well, you were locking up the mob working for the FBI back in the day, wearing a cowboy hat and a damn jumpsuit. But I don't really
looking like a car dealer.
I want to talk about Amir Locke, the situation with Amir Locke. I remember back when in 2020 summer, they had whoever was the governor. I mean, I'm sorry, the mayor back then. They tried to do something about no knock warrants back then. I can't really remember that situation. But I guess now they're saying that there's going to be a moratorium on no knock warrants. Now, I don't think.
While they do the investigation, to be clear.
Okay. It was temporary. You know, it's just really, really hard when it comes to police violence because the police are so powerful. I have a lot of conspiracy theories when it comes to the police. So I don't know if this is the appropriate time to say them, but you know, I was talking to somebody about this and they were saying, oh, you know, the mayor's got to do something. And I was like, honestly, in the real world, I don't think the mayor can really do much about the police departments. Like in the real world, I don't think so. You got to have a lot more going. There's just so much to do when it comes to the police violence. Now, when it comes to no-knock warrants, I do think that you know, you have a chance to say, hey, we're not going to be doing no-knock warrants here in this city or this municipality because it's, you know, it's really, you know, we saw the same thing when it came to Breonna Taylor. Like, it just leads to more violence. But it seems like that's what the police want, you know? Like, they're like, excited to get into some shootout or, like, you know, be terrorizing people, and especially Black people. Sadly, Amir Locke was caught in this situation. He tried to protect himself legally. That's probably not going to matter. We saw Philando Castile in Minnesota also. Just tell the police officer, hey, I have a weapon. I think he told him he has a license for it, and the guy just shot him. We'll see what happens with this trial. I'm not really optimistic about this one because it is a no-knock warrant. So I think the cops are going to say something like, well, we were already in fear for our life, and that's why we had to get this no-knock warrant. So, like, anything we did in there, like, it was justified. But we'll see. You know, we'll see what Keith Ellison can do. But it's a shame that we have another person losing their life unjustly. By the hands of the police. It won't be the last.
So, this one infuriated me a lot. for many reasons. A, the hypocritical, always hypocritical right-wing media will never talk about this. The people that are always gun rights ho activists, fucking libertarians who want to live in the wild, wild west, always say that there's government overreach of, oh my God, they're going to come into your house and kill you. This is literally an example of coming to your house and killing you. You're dead asleep at 3 a.m. You got a side piece with you because it might be turn. You know, it could turn up at any second. So you, I have a firearm under my gun. I have a firearm under my bed. So like, same thing for me. If shit pops off, you like, so as a responsible gun owner, like you can you legally can have a weapon.
And I want to give context, Sean, that like that place had been, the police had been to that apartment complex multiple times in the past year for different incidents, different things like that. Stuff is going on there. So there's a lot of a reason for that guy to be sleeping with the police.
Exactly. If you live in a bad area, you sleep with the police. Like it's, you know, a common practice. And a lot of these right-wing people, they do the same thing. When there's no-knock warrants, one of the most like atrocious things that the police department can do, and it's a government overreach, and like 100%, the fact that it can barge in on you, you know, whenever, just for, you know, a hunch of some sorts, and you have no idea. It's 3 a.m. You wake up. You have a side piece with you. You don't know if you're getting robbed. You don't know if like you're like. Example. I'll give a story. Story time. Last year, we had a guy try to break into our house. I wake up at 1 a.m, dead asleep. Like, mom comes rolling in, and side piece, right away. Like, I don't know what's going on. I'm, you know, dead tired. I don't know if someone's breaking in. I don't know what's happening, but, you know, you got to protect your family. You got to protect yourself. That's immediately what you do. But when it's the damn police that are supposed to protect and serve, that are supposed to help civilians out and everything, they're the ones doing the barging in. They're the ones doing the breaking in without telling you it's them. How is that protecting people? How is that good? And as someone, you know, who's, you know, I'm for gun rights, you know, I'm for, you know, learning how to properly handle and maintain a weapon, all that stuff. But that's, you know, different conversation for another day. Those people who are big, you know, the NRA and so on and so forth, they should be up in arms over this, literally, because this is the example of government overreach. For someone who legally owned a firearm comes up and uses it in a legal sense, like that's the whole reason you have is for self-defense, but it's the fucking cops who come up and they shoot you immediately. Like, how aren't you mad at that? It's just, it's absurd. And they're not going to talk about that because, you know, at the end of the day, those dudes are just racist. If it's happened to a black guy, like, oh, whatever, who gives a shit? But if it's some white dude that happens to, you know, might be, you know, that might be singing a different tone and whatnot. So those things need to be banned for sure. Like, the fact that they could still do that in this day and age is absolutely atrocious. And it shows you, again, the power that the police have. When we say, you know, when we say defund the police and whatnot, like, the biggest thing for me is, you know, defund the amount of power that they have. They shouldn't have this much power, this much control over our lives, right? Again, you want to talk to these libertarian, these right-wing peoples that talk about government overreach and all these things, you know, don't tread on me, flag-waving motherfuckers. This is the government overreach that you were so fearful of talking about. This is why we created this damn country anyways, because the English were patrolling the streets. The English were going around saying, you can't do this shit. And that's why we raised up and, you know, went against them for many other reasons. But this is the thing that's going on now in this day and age. And you're not talking about it. You know, it's only leftists and, you know, civil rights activist people and whatnot who talk about it. Not some fugazi fuck Al Sharpton who's over there who's a rat himself anyway. So who cares about him? Who cares about what he says? Jesus.
The Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus released a statement that was noting that Amir Locke was a law-abiding citizen who was lawfully in possession of a firearm.
Exactly. They said, the registered under his name.
I want to say their statement. The chairman, Brian Strasser, said, as seen in the body-worn camera video released by Minneapolis police, Mr. Locke appears to be sleeping on the couch during the execution of a no-knock warrant. He was awoken with a confusing array of commands coming from multiple officers who were pointing lights and firearms at him. Mr. Locke did what many of us might do in the same confusing circumstances. He reached for a legal means of self-defense while he sought to understand what was happening. And so the ACLU is said the ACLU is on the case. They're saying police failed to ask Mr. Locke to drop the gun or warn that they would shoot. There's a whole bunch of procedures here. But like the thing I want to get to is like kind of to what Sean's saying here. This is a country founded on a bunch of different amendments and rights for Americans in response to supposed freedoms and universal things that were stepped upon white men during the founding of this country at the time. And that goes to be said that the Second Amendment, let alone most of any constitutional rights, are not respected for people of color. The cops shouldn't have stormed in there, but as you're saying, no-knock warrants shouldn't have been issued in the first place if you have evidence that's this flimsy. And as Ryan Grimm notes in The Intercept, that this goes back in history, my claim that the Second Amendment is not for black people. As he's saying, the so-called black codes in the South pushed by the Klan included laws that specifically banned black people from owning guns. When federal law intervened, state and localities would tweak the laws to ban the kind of cheap models that were affordable to poor black people and poor white people. And they would set up other legal red tape similar to poll taxes, making it technically illegal to own a gun, technically legal to own a gun, but functionally impossible.
Look at Ronald Reagan in California. He, you know, he started gun to confiscating guns and stuff because of the Black Panther Party. Like, you have all these things against, you know, African Americans. It happens, you know, it's been the history of that. Second Amendment really is not meant for black people, which is atrocious. You can go back, you know, all the way down throughout American history where so many gun laws were made for the Black Panthers. Like, they, you know, open carry was banned in California because of that. Yeah. They were in Sacramento just chilling.
Let me get to that. After the Black Panthers became, continuing from the Ryan Grimm piece, after the Black Panthers began openly carrying firearms, Don Mulford, who was a conservative Republican, pushed a bill banning open carry specifically aimed at the Black Panthers, who at the time in the 1960s and 70s were like, well, damn, like white people are arming themselves. White people are saying that like they want segregated societies and they want like black people to be like self-sufficient, go on their own. All right, bet. We're going to have our own school programs. We're going to have our own school lunch programs. We're going to have our own community protection programs. And that was all well as good. That whole Second Amendment right to a well-armed militia shit was all well and good until the black people started doing it. And then you had the Mulford Act, which was passed and signed by Republican edgelord Ronald Reagan himself to make it so it was harder. So the assault weapons ban that everyone complains about, oh, California, that draconian ass gun laws. Oh, their policies are so crazy in California. The gun laws are ridiculous. You can't do anything in California. Thank Ronald Reagan for that. Okay? So that's all to say in the least bannable way I can possibly say on this platform. Like, if, as we come on the 2-year anniversary of the big George Floyd protest, where we saw directly what being black in America looks like to white America and to the police in America writ large, and we saw how quickly that all faded away and how little people actually cared about that, black people and people of color, marginalized groups in America, need to rationally and honestly assess what the Second Amendment looks like and means to them, how it's not intended for them, and to prepare themselves accordingly. I will leave it there.
May I?
Yes, go on.
I gotta check. No, I'm joking. I honestly, now this may be controversial. I don't think that the Second Amendment, how it's interpreted, I don't think that belongs in any functional democracy. Like, I don't think we're gonna have any real functional democracy in this country the way that we should with the Second Amendment, how it's interpreted. I don't think we can have 300 million guns, like however many guns we have in America, and it'd be like, you know, we're always going to be on the precipice of January 6th when we have the Second Amendment. I think we should have Mexico's gun laws.
Lately, I've been hearing an awful lot of white people's opinions about whether or not Joe Rogan is racist to black people this February, Black History Month. And so here's some content about one of the worst offenders on the so-called left of this, Kyle Kulinski, someone who I generally consider a friend, someone I get along with. But this is an important segment that I need to do. So he and his occasional co-host, Crystal Ball, were talking about some of the Rogan discourse and the backlash towards Spotify for giving him money to recklessly abuse the responsibility of his massive platform. And in it, Kyle tells this anecdotal story that he thinks paints Joe Rogan in a good light. I'm going to play that story. The only thing I'm really cutting out of this part will be the part where Kyle talks about the details of the video that he is making, but Kyle talks about the result of the video he makes in this clip. And so to cut down on some of the time, that's the part I cut out, but I wanted to play this part.
So I'm gonna tell a private story now.
Okay.
And I think people will like this story. So it wasn't that long ago, maybe a month or two ago, where Joe got in some trouble for, he was in a conversation with, I forget who it was, but he argued, Bridget Phetasy maybe it was? He argued against paid paternity leave.
Yes.
And he did it pretty glibly, and he took a stance. It was very like, this is what I think about this. I don't like it. Right. And so you and I saw that clip. Mm-hmm. I did not agree with him at all. So we decided, coming in to do this show, let's cover that in the intro. I want to play that clip and I want to respond to it. Did you know Joe watched that video? And then him and I were texting about it about a week later. And in a very long and detailed text conversation, he said in no uncertain terms, you convinced me. You changed my mind. I didn't know the stuff that you showed. And when I was talking on the podcast, I was just talking to another comedian, sort of talking shit, talking off the cuff. And I said something that now in retrospect, having learned more about it, I was wrong. And in fact, he even supports policies that go way further than that.
Yeah.
Like I was like, I support a 4-day work week. And he was like, I do too. It's like, well, that's way more time off than just paid paternity leave. You're like cutting down the work week so much when you do the math on how many weeks there are and like all the extra days you're getting off. UBI.
Yeah.
Because there was another thing that we were discussing about unemployment. And he was like, well, what if people are like sort of gaming the system a little bit? This is standard right-wing concern. I don't know who we heard it from, Ben Shapiro, Stephen Crowder, somebody like that, right?
Right, Crenshaw.
And I was like, Joe, I support universal basic income. I want everybody to get like $1,000 or $2,000 a month. And he's like, I support that too. So it's like, so you support a policy even to the left of just unemployment. And he's like, yeah, I guess I do. And so now the next time paid paternity leave or paid time off comes up, Joe's going to argue in favor of those things.
Yeah.
That's not possible if he's a dishonest actor, if he's a complete ideologue. And also, it wouldn't have been possible if you and I didn't believe in the power of persuasion.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, and by the way, I saw some of the comments on our video. Hmm.
There's so much about this clip that is probably inadvertently, but the reality is it's dismissive, it's glib, it just brushes away the actual concerns, and it really frustrates me. But the central argument is that Joe Rogan isn't perfect, but he's a reasonable guy who sometimes says dumb things, but he'll change his mind and his behavior if he can be convinced. And this is, once again, Kyle Kulinski being painfully and dangerously naive. I say once again because this isn't the first time he's done this, and so a pattern is now emerging. When Rogan apologized earlier this month for spreading COVID misinformation, he promised to do better. And less than 24 hours after that, he retweeted an incorrect report claiming that ivermectin was effective in treating against the Omicron variant. When the story was retracted later because that framing was incorrect and misleading, Joe deleted the tweet but didn't post any correction or reference to what his audience had already seen and taken as fact. And now his audience would internalize that the media is both out to get Joe Rogan for talking about these supposed COVID truths that you're not allowed to talk about, and that the media itself is hiding certain truths about COVID-19. Rather than Joe Rogan just taking the opportunity to inform his audience that he made a mistake, he might have made an honest mistake, this mistake that was informed by his own biases that he's built over the past 2 years of COVID misinformation from his right-wing buddies. But okay, it could have been a teachable moment for his audience, but instead, he just deleted it and decided to recover from the backlash or try to cover up from the backlash. And so there's a difference between Kyle Kulinski and Joe Rogan having a text conversation where Joe Rogan goes, oh, okay, I guess that's interesting. And Joe Rogan does the thing that Joe Rogan does where he will be agreeable to the person talking to him in any given time. There's a difference between that, Joe Rogan being agreeable to the person he's talking to in any given time, which might be Kyle Kulinski, and Joe Rogan's actions. Because Joe Rogan's actions are to brush off the criticisms and re-cocoon himself with his right-wing beer buddies and his comedy friends. like he'll have moments of clarity on one podcast only to not carry it with him in order to make an easy joke on another podcast and another podcast and every podcast thereafter. So what good is that teachable moment if the person you're teaching doesn't apply what they've learned? And this has been something that's been gone on for years. This has been something that leftists who are not white men who have talked about this for a long time. The LGBTQ community has been on this because Joe continues to be one of the main sources of misinformation on transgender people, even though he has supposedly had off-air conversations with people begging him to be more nuanced with his opinions of trans people in sports, for example, because violence against trans people is incredibly prevalent in society right now, unfortunately. And when you are someone with as large a platform as Joe Rogan, who's routinely talking about trans people and therefore shaping the opinions of people who have not met trans people but are very susceptible either way to either starting to understand and accept members of the human community or to find another group or an opportunity to be bigoted or confused towards a person. Joe continues to spread misinformation about trans people. And Joe has had black people on his show to say he's racist in the sense that, oh, he won't talk to black people or he thinks they're weird is like hard to say, of course, because he's had black people on his show. He's had respectful conversations with black comedians, black intellectuals. And there are moments where it seemed like his eyes were truly opening on race. His episode with Dr. Cornel West was one of the best episodes of the Joe Rogan podcast to date in this regard. But leftists can't point to those examples of Joe having a leftist here and a leftist there on a show and say, there, that's enough. He can be convinced. There, we did it, Patrick. We saved the city. That doesn't work that way. Because when Rogan has right-wingers on his show, not only does he have them very often, there's so many more Ben Shapiro episodes and Jordan Peterson episodes and all these other right-winger episodes. He gives so many more right-wingers a chance than he does left-wingers a chance. But never mind that. When the right-wingers show up on Joe Rogan's show, that's the information that Joe Rogan retains. When a right-winger is on Joe Rogan's show, he parrots their propaganda, even when it's almost always wrong. When someone on the left corrects Joe Rogan on his show, he immediately forgets about it, packs up, and moves to Texas. So racism or sexism or transphobia is more than whether or not you say a certain word or the context of the usage of that word at the time. Racism is action. Racism is hosting a massive platform where racist people can be given ammo for their hatred by saying, oh, is Michael Eric Dyson really black? What is real blackness? As though Joe Rogan, after thousands of episodes of doing this podcast and talking to black people about this very situation, is unable to make a smarter statement than that. If anything, I challenge Joe Rogan to be a better comedian, to be a smarter comedian, to show that he's actually growing his ape brain from however many years or so he's been doing the podcast. I'm using ape in the context that Joe Rogan uses ape, that I know is not a racial way, but he's saying like humans are derivative of monkeys. We're very like simple and monkey-like in that way. I'm referring to Joe Rogan as an ape in that context, but also in the fact that his comedy is kind of slow and fails to keep up with the times and instead falls into this, oh, I'm being canceled because people disagree with me kind of shtick. Racism is also responding to criticisms that you are using your platform to give ammo to racists to make it easier for bigots and homophobes to and transphobes and all these other people and Islamophobes and all these other people who hate other groups of people to make it easier for them to do that, to give them arguments, however flimsy, to do that. That's also racism, dude. It's more than just saying a word. It's more than just having people on your show. It's what do the actions actually turn out being? It's after years and years of doing this podcast. Is Joe Rogan retaining more of the things he's learning from left-wingers or right-wingers? This is a really obvious question for people of color, for leftists of color. But for some reason, a lot of white liberals and white so-called leftists love to pontificate around this concept as though it's a little bit out there, as though it's a little bit unclear. When it's painfully clear for the members of these marginalized groups that Joe Rogan has talked flippantly about over the years, because he's a comedian. It doesn't matter. This is my show. I'm not trying to be a political guy. But I'm going to talk about these topics and continue to grow my show by talking about these topics and then shirk myself of any responsibility. So for Kyle to say, oh, he's been reasonable with me before, I don't understand why other people are upset with him, strikes of a lot of naivety, but a certain familiar naivete to me that has nothing to do with race. It's the same type of naivete that he had with Jimmy Dore more than a half a year ago when Dore went on his unhinged tirades against others at TYT. And I've talked about Jimmy Dore more than I really want to, and this isn't really going to be about him. This is to note that Kyle Kalinske was a major defender of Jimmy Dore for a long time, and it only took the same things that Jimmy does to other people, the same things that people have said, that, oh, he starts being a loudmouth, he starts just being a jackass, he talks over you, he starts to like not make any rational sense, he makes clear he's just talking from his opinion and just, it's really malicious. Only when it starts to happen to Kyle Kalinske does he make a big deal about it. And even when that's happening, watching this clip, it was a whole second response that Kyle Kalinske had to make to Jimmy Dore, because Jimmy Dore is such a child in this whole matter, in the situation that happened 6 months ago or more. Watch how Kyle continues to treat Jimmy Dore with kid's gloves after being routinely, maliciously, and unfairly attacked by him.
I think you're a totally honest actor. I know you believe every single word you say. I know you're super passionate. I wouldn't doubt your integrity for a second. I think that the criticisms are absurd when people say you're a right winger or you're a grifter or whatever. So I just want to establish here, number one, a mutual respect. Number two, a friendship. But number three, and this is probably most important, he's showing here, okay, Kyle is a good faith actor. Kyle's a good faith actor. He's an honest person. What he's saying comes from a good place. He's not malicious. He's not a liar. He's not a smear merchant. You know, he's keeping it real. Okay, so we've established that. Wonderful. I do want you to take note, though. When it's stuff that I agree with them, that's their perception of me. You'll see when there's areas where we disagree, or where they think we disagree, or they don't like something I said or did, all of a sudden that assumption of good faith or that charitable interpretation, it goes out the window.
So Kyle Kalinske goes into the rest of that video, it's almost an hour long, where it kind of begins to show the beginning of the end of Kyle Kalinske's ability to have patience for Jimmy Dore. But that's only after Jimmy Dore does all of the same things that he had done to women and LGBTQ people and people of color, that Kyle Kalinske had been warned about way longer than before this moment, than before the moment we're talking about in question, where Kyle Kalinske has to realize that, oh, wow, everything that has people were saying about this person that I've been brushing off was true. And they're warning me because they care about me to some extent. And the people I keep fawning over, the people I keep giving the benefit of the doubt, the people who give me attention to some extent, and so we were friends in the past, but through their actions show they are not allied with the same people you claim to be allied with, those people, Kyle Kalinske keeps giving a pass. And so it's not about Kyle Kalinske wanting to expand his audience. You could arguably make that case with Joe Rogan, but honestly, I don't. And even on YouTube, there's no such benefit between Kyle Kalinske and Jimmy. Kyle's been in the game longer, and when it comes to the male, white, quote-unquote left political space, they have a lot of audience overlap already. But why is it that Kyle Kalinske will do backflips to defend white male comedians who wade into politics to play both sides, but mostly court right-wingers? White male comedians who do effectively no political reading or work of any kind, yet have no problem hosting influential political shows and talking on influential political issues and making statements and assuasions that have actual real world impacts in the world of politics and social issues and life. Why will Kyle Kulinski defend those people over the warnings of the people who are on his side politically very clearly? The people who are in his audience who are telling him that the continued support of characters like this is making it difficult to trust that Kyle Kulinski's judgment in what he's saying and when he's dissecting the news for his audience is something that is tangible. Because if you're missing out on if Kyle Kulinski is missing out on Jimmy Dore and Joe Rogan, I got to start to question, what else are you missing out on? What other things are you missing? What other things are you too naive for? And where does this naivety that prevents him from giving his audience the best information come from? If I didn't know Kyle better, I'd say it's because him and Jimmy and Joe are all white dudes, and their life experience is more relatable to him than it is to the people who are being critical of those people. And I might sound harsh. I understand this sounds very harsh, especially coming from a black person, but I swear to you, I am your kindest ally in this battle, because there are people way more pissed off about your support and other people's support of Joe Rogan, and they see it as an absolute turning of the backs towards leftist people of color. And they have long memories about this stuff. You're asleep at the wheel, and the lives of marginalized groups are at stake because of your negligence as a host to not see your own biases and use your platform to speak truth and call out the powerful, like you committed to doing, Kyle, when you started Secular Talk in the first place. You have a little bit of influence now. Joe Rogan's at the center of media controversy. He's a major right-wing commentator, whether he knows it or not. And I think there is some demonstrated ability for Kyle Kulinski to change Joe Rogan's mind. So Kyle, you're in the position of power. You are directly in it. Are you going to be friends with him? Because that's nice for you? Are you going to use that power on behalf of the things that you believe on? The things that you believe, the things that you started your show on. Do those principles matter to you? In the video I started the segment with, Kyle's co-host Crystal Ball repeated a mantra from another white liberal who tries to speak for everyone, Jon Stewart. So I'll play that clip now.
The key thing there, obviously, the entirety of his argument is don't leave, don't abandon, don't censor, engage. And if there ever was a guy who you could do that with, it is Joe Rogan.
Dismissive. Almost mocking of the legitimate concerns of people of color on the left, of marginalized groups on the left. If there is anyone, do you really want to check your words there, Crystal? Anyone? Like Joe Rogan, who has been peddling trans misinformation? Anyone like Joe Rogan, who continues to say racially dumb shit? 1,500 episodes, multiple black people interviews, multiple supposed deep conversations and supposedly learning these things. He's the reasonable one? Crystal Ball, what the hell are you doing? Do you have access to Joe Rogan? What conversations are you having with him to make sure he actually retains this information, to make sure he actually holds his feet to the fire, to make sure he actually practices this leftist knowledge and actually challenges right-wingers on the show? Because otherwise, okay, maybe Joe Rogan didn't sign up to do this, but this is the bet he's made. So are you going to give him credit because he's a white guy and giving him a lot of this responsibility right now that he didn't ask for is a lot to do? Or are you going to do your jobs as supposed political pundits who hold people's feet to the fire? Balls in your court. Because here is another example of Joe Rogan, who Kyle Kulinski and Crystal Ball say really means well, who is really being treated unfairly, who continuously is messing up. Here's where it actually fucking matters. There was a story Joe Rogan shared to his Instagram following of over 14 million people just a few weeks ago. 14 million people who are susceptible to the lies I'm about to tell you here, okay? It was about the Union Pacific Railways in Los Angeles being filled with trash and debris. And this was a report that was done on a number of different outlets. I think Inside Edition in Los Angeles picked this up as well. And this is reportedly after a string of rail car thefts that fits right in with a right-wing message being fed to Joe Rogan and that he's been parroting for months, if not years. Joe Rogan comments, LA fell apart so quickly at these images of trash all over railways as these rail cars have been looted. But that wasn't the full story, because Joe Rogan would have you believe that, oh, crime is out of control and Los Angeles is just absolutely out of control and it's a mess here and people are just looting these rail cars and people aren't getting their packages and freight's all missing and it's all this fault because of what liberals are doing. But it turns out that, as is always the case with Joe Rogan, as is almost always the case, he is just repeating the stuff that is being spoon-fed to him by right-wingers and corporatists. And here's exactly how that happened. It turns out that Union Pacific posted their most profitable year ever in 2021. And that was after 2020 was also turbulent, but turned out being very profitable as well. And despite this, Union Pacific laid off thousands of workers, including Union Pacific's own internal police department. So by their own recollections, their own reporting, they had their most profitable year ever. This is a press release they had. Yet at the same time, they didn't mention this during the press release, but this is what they're doing. They laid off thousands of workers, including the people who make sure the rail cars are secure as they're in transit. So you fire all the people who secure the rail cars. All of a sudden, the rail cars are being ransacked because there's no one to watch over them. And by the way, a lot of people without jobs who know where the rail cars are going now, by the way. And Union Pacific has the gall to go out and blame the city of Los Angeles. BNSF is another major freight operator in the Los Angeles area, so they compete with Union Pacific. And they haven't seen the kind of thefts that Union Pacific has, is the thing that Jalopnik is reporting. So it makes it really strange that Union Pacific is blaming the increase of thefts on the ability for criminals to post no cash bail in LA, which has made it so you couldn't have, rich people break the law, they can just spend their way and get out of jail. Poor people break the law, they're stuck because of cash bail. This makes the system a lot more equitable. But Union Pacific said, well, because there's no cash bail, all these criminals are able to flaunt the fact that they're able to just run out and do the crime again. Rather than the obvious cause of effect here, that Union Pacific had record profits, saw a way of cutting costs by firing workers, and then Union Pacific acting shocked that the job those workers were doing is no longer getting done. And so Union Pacific put out this thing that, oh, it's LA's policies, it's defund the police, it's all this other nonsense, stuff that feeds into right-wing propaganda that Joe Rogan has been fed and has taken hook, line, and sinker for the past several years. Even with left-wingers supposedly in his ear on these things. And Rogan repeats this to his audience of people who are supposedly against media manipulation and want the real story. Joe Rogan is a simp for Republicans and corporate labor profiteers. And again, with Rogan amplifying this anti-worker, anti-leftist, right-wing corporate lie on social media and on his podcasts, I'm looking for, Kyle, where are your texts on this? Where, Crystal Ball, is the most reasonable man you can possibly convince, Joe Rogan, on this anti-worker propagandistic bullshit? I can speculate very, very easily as to why Kyle Kalinske and Crystal Ball and so many others are blinded by the white of Joe Rogan when his actions clearly show he doesn't care about putting these moments of learning into practice. However, Crystal Ball and Kyle Kalinske are part of the left. They are part of my left. And so I'll give them an opportunity to continue this dialogue with myself and other concerned leftists of color. They can also choose to ignore me, and then I will simply become unignorable on this point, because I know I'm right, and I know they're wrong, and this is a point that me and actual people who have stake in this game, and frankly the rest of the left, as far as the future of the left goes, cannot and will not let go of. So let me reiterate, leftist whites with platforms, you have an choice. Continue caping for the white dudes with large platforms who should know how to use them better and making excuses for them, or stop acting like hypocrites and stand up for the marginalized groups you make your livings claiming to care about on the internet. Because your actions will speak louder than your words, as they do for Joe Rogan, and as they will for y'all. This has been episode 40 of Your Power Report, and there's even more where that came from for Syndicate 23 members who get bonus segments on everything we do for Power Report, including this week we're doing stuff on the Canadian trucker situation and stuff on Gavin Newsom pretending to fight for Medicare for All. This stuff happens the same way all the other stuff happens with member support. And by the way, I am way tinier than Joe Rogan or Kyle Kalinske or Crystal Ball, but I've demonstrated that I swim in these circles. I have similar amounts of knowledge to them, and I actually haven't lost the plot of why we do this talk show stuff in the first place. It's to make a better world. It's to keep each other honest and accountable and be clear about what is stopping us from getting to that better place. And if we keep having this circular argument on the left over whether or not Joe Rogan is gettable or whether or not he's winnable, instead of actually applying that and putting it to practice, then it is just another way in which strategically the left will talk a lot of talk but fail to deliver for people when marginalized communities are on the line because right-wingers are way better at this game. So go to join.syndicate23.co. Start joining for as little as $5 a month. Get all the bonus content. Help me support and get way more of this where it came from. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan from the Web, on Instagram at Dan from the Internet, on TikTok at Dan from the Internet. Also check out the Good Morning Bad News videos we're doing. I know I mentioned that earlier in the show, but on TikTok, we just crossed 1 million followers, and I cannot say how thrilled and honored I am to be a part of that. And since I'm not a part of that, there are other people who are working behind the scenes. I'm not the only person on Good Morning Bad News, but it is great to be at least be a part of that team and to continue to grow that into something that is a really powerful engine for leftist political education. And so follow Power Report on Twitter at Power Report WRLD. Follow on Instagram at powerreport.world. And check us out next time. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube, youtube.com/DanFromTheInternet, or wherever you're listening to podcasts, Spotify included, because we're small and we have to grow. Because remember, the power is with you. And we're going to need your help to make sure that we keep the powerful in check. Because there aren't a lot of people doing it. There definitely aren't enough. And so I'll need your help to do it. Thank you. Have a good week.